8:40 the time, 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. Welcome to a Tuesday edition of the Mornings with Ed Show. Delighted to have you here. Super important conversation. We've been looking forward to this for a while. Katie Porter is running for re-election, currently serving the 45th District of California. Now she's serving, she's running for our 47th Congressional District. Her focus these last couple of years has been holding corporate power accountable. And she does this by asking tough questions and presenting legislation that levels the playing field for American families. She has not accepted corporate PAC money in her bid for Congress, and she cited an overhaul of campaign finance laws and protection of voting rights as legislative priorities moving forward. Joining us for the conversation this morning is Congresswoman Katie Porter. Congresswoman, thank you for being here today.
I'm excited to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. I know it's limited, so I'm going to try and cram 40 minutes worth of conversation into just about 20 minutes, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely, and I look forward to coming back on soon.
All right, I look forward to that as well. I'd like to take us through some of the legislation that you've introduced and some of the expectations behind it. You introduced legislation that would strengthen accountability for big corporations that are engaging in coordinated price hikes. It's called the Competitive Prices Act, and it closes loopholes that price-gouging corporations exploit to escape accountability. In antitrust cases. Where specifically have you seen it the most egregious, and how do we define accountability? How do they pay the price?
Yep, so the Competitive Prices Act is designed to strengthen our capitalist economy, make sure we have a level playing field for big, established multinational corporations and smaller startups, and to make sure that consumers have price transparency and have choice and competition in the marketplace. This inflation that we've seen this last year has been really different from the inflation of the last 20 years. Today's inflation, about half of it, is coming from excessive profits. That is, profits beyond what is typical. So in the past, inflation has been mostly a result of supply chain issues, of higher labor costs. But over half of the inflation, over half of what we're feeling at the grocery store when we put something in the cart, is coming from corporations wreaking extra profit out of consumers. And they're able to do that, and this is really important, the corporations that are best able to do that are corporations that have monopoly power, where there's only one, two, or three corporations in a marketplace. Let's take food prices. Four companies control 80% of the American beef market. Four companies control 80% of the soybean market. Three companies control 78% of the pasta market. We have a cereal monopoly in this country, a bread monopoly in this country, and consumers are feeling it in the grocery store. So what my act would do is, if there was a coordinated price hike, if we saw the two dominant or three dominant competitors in a marketplace move their prices up at the exact same time, it would allow regulators to go in to do an antitrust investigation and to sue to force them to bring those prices back down.
Wow. So years and years ago, we broke up Ma Bell. And do we see something like that happening in the future, breaking up some of these companies?
Well, I think one of the challenges with some of these corporations, some of these entities like telephone, airline, is that they're highly regulated industries. But in other places, we have seen consolidation across even industries where there historically was a lot of competition. So food is a really good example, again, because historically we've had lots and lots and lots of different manufacturers of food competing. We've had lots of farmers. We've had lots of packing plants. And now we don't see that anymore. So today, you know, my constituents and I talk about this, my voters and I talk about this, it's hard to think of an industry where there isn't a monopoly. And I think consumers want to have that choice. They want to feel like they're getting a fair price. And the reality today is the evidence, the data is very clear. Half of what we're feeling at the grocery store, at the pump, and when we purchase things that our family needs, is coming from corporations boosting profits. And by the way, you don't need to believe me. Listen to corporate CEOs. They have said that inflation gives them an excuse to raise profits. They have said that on their earnings calls to their investors, and the government needs to do something about that, because that's not healthy competitive capitalism, which I'm a champion for.
Right. And you mentioned at the pump. So you also introduced legislation to protect taxpayers from funding climate misinformation, and that's the end of subsidies for fossil fuel advertising act is what it's called. And it would end taxpayer subsidies for industry advertisements that encourage the continued use of oil and gas. I've got two questions there for you. Can you overcome the money that big oil would pour into the opposition to this? And in a worst case scenario, couldn't we hold them to a sort of truth in advertising corner like we did with the tobacco companies?
Yeah, so the goal here is to make sure that our marketplace, as consumers are thinking about whether to, you know, buy a gas-powered vehicle or an electric vehicle, and they're thinking about different kinds of energy choices or appliances, about plastic, they're getting accurate information. And so what this does is simply remove the tax benefit that big oil companies get when they put climate misinformation out there. We're not impinging on their speech. They can still do it, but we're not going to subsidize it as taxpayers to have our marketplace distorted. We want people to have accurate information. And this greenwashing, which big oil has been engaged in now for a couple decades, is starting to spread to a lot of other corporations. So I've recently seen at the airport, you know, a big billboard saying, fly our airline. It's, you know, we're the greener airline. There is no fairy dust that makes airplanes go. Those are going to be powered by fossil fuel for the foreseeable future. But that effort to kind of convince people that there isn't an environmental impact really distorts our ability to make choices as consumers, as Americans, about how best to take care of our planet and how best to protect our fragile coastal community.
Right. And you mentioned oil companies. Let's stay on that for a second. Are you in favor of a windfall tax for oil companies?
I have supported a windfall tax for oil companies, again, because it's windfall. Everybody understands corporations need to cover their costs. If the price of crude oil is going up or the price of refining is going up, we would understand that would be passed along to us at the pump. But that's not what we're seeing, especially not in California, where there is an excess price charge well beyond any differential in California's taxes or environmental processes. It's simply price gouging for Californians. So, yes, I do support a windfall profit tax. I think it has to be well-designed to make sure that it's accounting for the fact that oil is a commodity and there will be market fluctuations. I think we have to be understanding about that. But when it's simply gouging, when it's every price just goes up and up, when the price of oil goes up, the price of gas goes up. I got it. I'm frustrated. I think Americans are frustrated when the price of oil falls. Why isn't the price of gas falling too?
Right. We're all thinking that at the pump. We really are. My next question, I'll give the general for the audience, and then I want to specify the question for Laguna Beach itself. A bill that you introduced recently passed to create mental health first responder units that would empower state and local governments to send trained mental health professionals instead of police when 911 is called for someone experiencing a mental health crisis. Here in Laguna Beach, and how many trained mental health professionals would you expect to have in a city the size of Laguna Beach? And would each city themselves be responsible for the cost of these professionals, or do you see the federal or state governments offering assistance?
Great question. So let me step back and explain what the Mental Health Justice Act does. It funds cities, counties, tribal communities who want to use this approach to provide better care for people in their community and reduce their costs. So it's up to each city. It would create a grant program, $250 million, where a city like Laguna could apply to get the funding to hire these trained healthcare, mental health care responders. The police and the dispatch would be up to the professional judgment of that trained dispatch person with, you know, the experience that they have with law enforcement, with emergencies, to decide, is it better in this situation to send a police officer? Is this a fire situation? Is this a mental health care situation? These programs, and this is really important, these programs have been piloted around the country, in Eugene, Oregon, in Denver, and closer to our own backyard in places like Huntington Beach and Irvine. And they not only connect people to healthcare, they increase the people's willingness to call for help because they reduce the stigma of the police coming in a mental health situation, and they save an incredible amount of time and resources from our police department, who are not able to necessarily provide the healthcare in those situations. And it lets our police focus on preventing crime, on keeping people safe in dangerous situations, and it lets people who are ill get the care that they need.
Excellent. Thank you for that explanation. I want to talk about the election for a moment, and let's talk about your opponent for a second. Scott Baugh has been invited on the program, and that invitation stays open as long as until the election, but we have yet to hear back. Though he scrubbed his webpage and social media accounts before the general election, he said as recently as May of this year that life begins at conception. He then went on to conflate conception with viability. And by saying we need to promote a culture of life in America, not a culture of termination. Yet, he gets an A rating from the NRA and opposes an assault weapons ban. In your opinion, does he throw his credibility out the window with this glaring apparent hypocrisy?
Look, I think we need to be clear about what Scott Baugh will do if he is elected. He will vote for a nationwide abortion ban. He has said that many, many times. His endorsements, his record from agencies that oppose, from organizations that oppose abortion, is crystal clear. This is not a newcomer to the political scene. This is someone who has a long career as a lobbyist, as a Republican Party operative, in the Republican Assembly. And throughout all of those years, he has been very, very clear. He absolutely opposes any abortion for any women, including, he has said, for no exceptions for rape or incest. He's also said he would vote against legalizing gay marriage. And as we all know, he has an A rating from the NRA. That grade speaks for itself. And I think voters, especially after the recent church shooting in Laguna Woods, after what happened in Uvalde, I hear a lot from voters that they want our communities to be safe. And we need people who are willing to stand up to the NRA and stand up to the gun lobby to pass those kinds of reforms that will really keep our community healthy and safe.
Okay. And you mentioned abortion. And with the SCOTUS decision to terminate Roe, we grew up being taught that we live in a system of checks and balances. Who checks SCOTUS? And other than the lifetime process of waiting them out, how should we remedy a radical Supreme Court?
Great question, Ed. So I think this is important for people to think through, and I've been having lots of conversations about this and really appreciate voters wanting to learn about this. What the SCOTUS decision says, the reversal of Roe, the Dobbs decision, is that there's no constitutional backstop. There's no backstop to the Constitution. If a state or our Congress were to pass a nationwide abortion ban, it would go into effect. There would be no ability to challenge that constitutionally under current law. So what this means is the backstop for the Supreme Court on abortion is all of us as voters. It's going to be decided on this ballot. So if you want to make sure that people have the ability to make their own choices about their when and if to start a family, their own healthcare decisions, whatever those may be, I respect them, then that's why control of Congress, that's why this election matters, because we, the voters, are the backstop here to the Supreme Court. This is now a legislative issue rather than being a constitutional court one. And I think that's something really, really important for voters to understand. There's no way for California to get out of this. If Congress passes a nationwide abortion ban, like Scott Baugh has said he will, then we will lose our freedoms and our rights here in California.
Well stated. This next question may be a little bit out of left field, but I know we're all paying attention to the January 6th committee hearings, and I know you're not on the committee, but indulge me for a moment. We've all obviously been watching and paying attention to it, and the committee has done great work. And knowing that we're not going to hear directly from Mike Pence or Mark Meadows or Kevin McCarthy, is there a question that you'd want answered from any one of them, and what would that question be?
Oh, that's a great one. I'm not sure I have a particular question. I will tell you, I spend about a week before I do any 5-minute congressional hearing preparing, rehearsing, deciding what will be exactly what I want to ask. I do think the January 6th Commission has been really important in showing Americans exactly what happened and exactly how the pieces between the pre-planning, the president's statements to these supporters, the coordination that was involved, and the loss of human life that we saw in the Capitol, including the life of Capitol police officers who protected us. So I think, you know, what we're seeing and learning is that a lot of these folks knew what was happening was wrong, and they knew that it needed to stop, but they weren't willing to stand up to Trump for it. And I think that's the kind of question I would want to hear from Mark Meadows or Mike Pence. Why didn't you stand up to Donald Trump? If you did stand up to Donald Trump, what happened? Because I think we have to count on our leaders. Yes, they're going to have party, you know, affiliations. Yes, they're going to have different values. But at the end of the day, there is no greater purpose for our Congress than to keep Americans and our democracy safe. And those leaders all failed in that moment. And they can't just say it's Trump's fault. They have to take some responsibility and some accountability themselves. That's what it means to be a leader. I think about that a lot in this election.
Okay, thank you for that. After the election, when it's over, what's your biggest priority the first session after the election, the first session of Congress?
Well, one of the things that I worked on a lot this Congress that we didn't get over the finish line was thinking about how to make childcare more affordable for families. In about half of all states, including right here in Orange County, childcare, a year of childcare costs more than a year of in-state college tuition. And we're hearing from businesses that they're having trouble finding workers. And one of the things we can do is make sure that people who want to work, if their parents have young kids or they need senior or elder care, that they're able to afford to get it. That's not just something that about parents or kids. That's something that strengthens our entire economy, making sure we have that vibrant workforce. And the pandemic really decimated the number of childcare providers. It also reduced the number of teachers. I'm a parent of three kids in public school here in Irvine, so I see that squeeze on our school systems. So that is a huge focus of mine. It's really something about making sure that we have that workforce that we need to continue to grow our economy for years to come. The other thing I'm going to continue to push on is holding big pharma accountable. As you may know, Congress passed a law to allow Medicare to begin negotiating drug prices and to cap what seniors will have to pay for drugs at $2,000 per year. I salute both of those things. I proudly voted for them. I think I'm a champion for expanding and protecting Medicare and Social Security. But I think we also have to recognize that drug prices are a problem for all Americans, not just for our seniors. And I think there's more work to hold Big Pharma accountable. I have a track record of doing that, and I look forward to getting right back to it after this election.
Well, thank you for that. And how do our listeners learn more about you? Where will you be in the next couple of days? Where can we find you?
I'll be right here in Orange County campaigning in the new 47th Congressional District. It runs from Seal Beach down to Huntington Beach, Costa Mesa, Irvine, Newport Beach, and Laguna Beach. I have a couple tiny little corners of Laguna Hills and Laguna Woods. So I'll be out in the community having events, knocking on doors. You can learn more about my campaign and about me at katieporter.com.
Katie Porter, running for re-election, this time in California's 47th Congressional District. The very best of luck to you, and we look forward to having you back on the show. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much, Ed.
You have a great day.
You too.
Thank you. 8:57 the time. It's the Mornings with Ed Show.